Chapter 3. Your Emotional Floor Plan. When I was struggling in my own long-term sexual connection, I felt stuck. In terms of the party metaphor, my partner and I both knew that if we could get to the party, we would have fun. But it just felt like so much effort to get off the sofa and into bed. I love you, my metaphorical self would say to my party-throwing partner, and I love going to parties with you. I flop onto the sofa, magically transitioning into my comfiest pajamas on the way down like a TikTok video. I can't. I was stuck on this metaphorical sofa, stuck in my pajamas, stuck in a state of mind that made sexual pleasure feel a million miles away. My stuckness was difficult for my partner, too. Everyone has a bad day, or week, or month. But when it happens over and over again, you, the party-throwing friend, might start to have some feelings about how your friend just can't. You might start to feel like your friend doesn't care enough to try. You might feel like, well, if your friend can't be bothered to show up, then maybe you shouldn't invite this friend to parties anymore. You might begin to worry that your friend doesn't enjoy the parties, or that your friend doesn't love you enough to show up to the party, that there's something wrong with the relationship itself. Of course, I wasn't literally stuck on a sofa. I was stuck somewhere in my emotional brain, and I couldn't find my way out of it and into an erotic space in my mind. Maybe you're in a similar boat. Maybe you like the sex you would be having if only you could bring yourself to have it, but you're swamped with overwhelm, exhaustion, stress, depression, anxiety, repressed rage. We've all got it. Or maybe you're stuck in a role that's incompatible with erotic connection. You're always in parent mode, or caretaking mode, or job mode. If that's the case, your problem is not your lack of desire. It's your stuckness. If you're stuck, no wonder you can't want sex. To get unstuck, I learned to map my emotional floor plan, understanding how I might get from wherever I was, physically exhausted, anxious, frustrated, to a sexy state of mind. And that's what I want you to do. In this chapter, you'll develop a kind of map of the different emotional states that exist in your brain that will show you how to navigate those spaces to find yourself in the vicinity of the erotic. These rooms include 7 core or primary emotional spaces in your brain. 4 of the 7 systems are what I'll call pleasure favorable, meaning they are spaces where it's easier to access pleasure. They generally feel good, and we are motivated to experience them. Lust, play, seeking, and care. And 3 systems are pleasure adverse, meaning they are spaces where pleasure seems far away. They are generally uncomfortable, and we are motivated to avoid them. Panic grief, fear, and rage. Jaak Panksepp, the father of affective neuroscience and the researcher who developed this framework, put the terms in all caps to differentiate them from the day-to-day meanings of these words. It's not lowercase lust in the ordinary sense of a person's experience of sexual desire, but rather all caps lust in the technical sense of the network of brain systems whose activation generates mammalian behaviors and experiences related to courtship and sexual behavior. To these 7 emotional spaces, I will add 2 bonus spaces: the thinking mind, or the office, where you plan and reason, and observational distance, or the scenic viewpoint, for noticing your own internal experience with non-judgment. The 7 primary emotional spaces, plus the bonus spaces, comprise much of our internal context. We're going to think of these spaces as rooms in your brain, laid out in an emotional floor plan. At any given moment, you are in one room or between rooms, and depending where you are in your emotional floor plan making your way to the vicinity of the lust room can be easy or difficult. Illustrations of these rooms and some example floor plans are available in the downloadable PDF that accompanies this book. Some of you will use the floor plan pretty literally, creating an architectural map of the spaces and how they relate to each of the other spaces. I'll describe several examples throughout this chapter. But some of you, maybe those who think more verbally or emotionally than spatially, may prefer to think of the floor plan as a dream space, where you transition from one space to another without logic or order, where different emotional spaces appear around you spontaneously and shift in ways a room in the waking world never could. Some of you may find the floor plan metaphor doesn't work for you. You'll find some alternatives in this endnote. Maybe you prefer to think of these primary process emotions as characters in your personality. John Gottman offered that type of metaphor to understand these core emotional systems in his 2001 book, The Relationship Cure. He gave each a name and a task. The jester, the nest builder, the explorer, etc. You can do the same thing, thinking about which character moves to the forefront of your mental states as your context changes. Or maybe each space is a color, and you can identify where you are by the color that feels right. Or maybe each space is a song that evokes a particular emotion. Or maybe you feel most comfortable with the more literal language of primary process emotions being activated as neural networks. Super! Map out the activation and the processes of transitioning from one to the other, and the process of activating more than one network at a time. Nan Wise went into detail in her 2020 book, Why Good Sex Matters. And if you want to know even more thoroughly what the science already has to say about this, The Archaeology of Mind by Jaak Panksepp and Lucy Biven is a detailed place to start. The floor plan isn't what matters. It's just a metaphor for the actual hardware of your emotional brain. If you can identify the emotions in yourself and understand what moves you into and out of these states, that's what matters. A few of us nerdy authors, like John Gottman and Nan Wise, have been gently pushing Panksepp's model into the mainstream because we believe it can help people in their daily lives. In understanding that these different systems coexist in our brains, we can notice how we and our loved ones move from one mental state to another. Then, whenever we're interested in transitioning from one space to another, or our partner asks for help transitioning, we know how. The goal, regardless of your preferred metaphor, is to trace the ways you transition into an erotic state of mind from some other state of mind. Pay attention to which transitions are most effortless and which most effortful. Fair warning, this is the longest and most sciencey chapter, but it changes people's lives. It changes how people understand themselves and their partners as erotic beings. I have done my best to make it accessible and easy to apply to your life. It's a lot, but it's worth it. Let's go room by room in your mental floor plan and find out what each space is like and how they all relate to one another. The pleasure favorable spaces. Lust. Lust is the space of courtship and sexuality. In humans, it's a highly social space and is most often surrounded by the other pleasure favorable, highly social spaces of care and play. Lust is everything from sexual attraction through arousal, desire, and orgasm. It's a mental space in which any and every sensation may be interpreted as erotic. What are some things that activate lust inside you? What causes sexual pleasure to rise? When is it easy to allow desire to grow? The lust's evolutionary origin is reproduction. Humans, along with a variety of other mammals, go to the lust space for lots of reasons, most of them non-reproductive, many of them social. For most people, the lust space in our emotional brains is adjacent to the other three pleasure-favorable emotional spaces, seeking, play, and care. all of which I'll discuss in more detail in the sections that follow. Most often, the way we get into a lustful state of mind is by going through one of those three spaces. Can you think of a time when the transition to sexual desire was easy? When initiation happened without anyone having to worry or try hard? When pleasure happened without effort? What was happening in the minutes, hours, and even days leading up to the shift into the erotic? How do you feel about your lust space? While we've been taught to have feelings about many of the spaces in our emotional floor plan, lust may be the one we've most likely been taught to feel ashamed of, not least because we were taught to be ashamed of pleasure. For people with consistently lower sexual desire than their partner, you may feel like a failure or a bad person because you can't find your way into lust. For those with consistently higher desire, you may feel like a bad person because lust seems ever present. The most important thing to remember is that there is no correct level of desire, and you have nothing to feel ashamed of about your lust space. The highest desire person I've ever talked to could have sex and, mere minutes later, be just as interested in having sex as she was before she and her partner started. Nothing, not stress, not pregnancy, not illness, nothing made her desire for sex go away. Over time, and with the help of a loving partner, she has learned she need not feel ashamed of her desire. She told me, "I have felt shame around how important sex is to me, without a doubt. Every partner I've ever been with has had a lower sex drive, but I know I'd rather have really good, intuitive sex once a week, once a month, than sex where my partner's totally checked out twice a week. I've come to a place where I actively work to make sure my partner doesn't feel obligated to have sex with me. We get there through a lot of talking, which I'm not a fan of, but we have those conversations where I'm able to iterate and reiterate, if you don't want to have sex with me, I'd rather not have sex with you." She learned that she was not entitled to sex just because she wanted it, and that sex with partners who were there out of a sense of obligation was not sex worth having. In her relationship now, she and her wife have a clear understanding. There is no obligation, ever. There's just an open door and a welcome mat, always. As you consider the lust space in your emotional mind, ask yourself the questions, how do you know you're in that space? What happens in your body, thoughts, and emotions when you're there? How do you feel about this space? What pulls you into that space, and what pushes you out? Play. Play is the space of friendship and laughter, singing and dancing, games of all kinds, with zero stakes. In our daily lives, we might describe the play space in our minds with words like fun or joy. But more technically, play is activity done with no immediate purpose for its own sake, just because everyone involved likes it. You can recognize play by the facial and vocal reactions of participants: laughter, smiles, wide open mouths, cheering. When you're in play, there is nothing at stake, only fun to be had. Play can be a lot of things. There is rough and tumble play, like dogs or children chasing each other and wrestling. There's fantasy play, like children playing dress up and inventing stories. There's word play, like jokes, rhymes, and rhythms. Freestyle rap battles are play. Singing, dancing, and chanting are play. The internet meme that queefing, vaginal farts, is when the small unicorn that lives inside your vagina sneezes. That's play too. Taking something people sometimes feel embarrassed or even ashamed about and turning it into a giggle. There's object and sensory play. Everything from splashing in the bath or a pool to doing a jigsaw puzzle. Once we know what an object is through seeking exploration, we transition to, what can I make this object do? Or, what can I do with this object? We manipulate our environment with our bodies to see what happens. And when something unexpected but safe happens, we feel the thrill of discovery. In all its various forms, play is the foundation of friendship. If you have gotten to lust through play, maybe you and your partner were playing literal games, whether physical sports or bananagrams. Maybe you are roughhousing and the physical touch and heavy breathing changed the mood. The laughter and friendship building of play might be the most underrated yet common paths to lust. Manual and oral sex at their best can be object play, activity done with no immediate purpose, for its own sake, just because everyone involved likes it, in which we explore our partner's genitals to see what happens when we try certain movements at different speeds or with different pressure. What can I make this object do? One couple I know discovered the value of play when they finally, after years of reluctance and resistance, scheduled a weekly date night. Their resistance came from the sense that a scheduled time was too much pressure, too much expectation that now you have to have sex. Where was the desire? Where was the fun? Sex you had to schedule could never be worth having because when they felt like they had to do something, they immediately did not want to do it. But they had been struggling with infrequent sex, both wanting in principle to have sex more often, but neither able to make it happen. They had tried so many things, and still they were stuck. So they considered scheduling a sex night. Then one of them had a brilliant idea that instead of sex night, it was game night. They bought a set of those silly sex dice, and it turned out the silliness was what made the difference. Come game night, they alternated rolls of the dice. One partner told me, when we started, I thought the ritual would do what it hasn't done, which is prime the pump so we'd have sex more often. But what it did was, during the most stressful times, times when one or both of us were just crawling out of our skin stressed, it kept us connected erotically, even when anything else was just not going to happen. No, they weren't having what they usually considered sex more often, but they were sharing pleasure, touching each other playfully and lovingly. That's one example of what centering pleasure instead of desire can look like. It can look like sustaining an erotic connection even through the most stressful seasons of your lives by playing together. If it were up to me, almost all the sex in mainstream media would be full of giggling and laughter, jokes, wrestling, puns, and playing pretend. It would be like President and Dr. Bartlett on election night in season 4 of The West Wing, with the president half-ironically describing all the states he won and murmuring, "Who's your commander-in-chief?" And her answering in a breathy voice, "You are." But almost no sex in the mainstream media is any damn fun. Why? Because play is, by definition, low stakes. And anybody who writes stories knows you're supposed to keep the stakes high to keep the audience engaged. Why watch people have zero stakes laughing sex just for the fun of it? Here's reason number 74 billion why sex in the media, mainstream or porn, is not like sex in real life. In real life, you want high stakes to be the exception, not the rule. What are you doing when you experience the feeling of lightness, laughter, and friendship? When is your face relaxed and your attention almost effortlessly attuned to the present moment? What kind of play feels good to you? What kind of play feels good to your partner? What kind of play might make it feel easy to slide through the doorway into the sexy times room? For me, play is jokes, and silliness rather than physical play. For a friend of mine, it's chasing, wrestling, and tickling. For some people, it's playful competition. For others, it's playful collaboration. Which feels more friendship building to you, playing against someone on an opposing team or playing with someone on the same team? Another woman, on learning about the emotional floor plan, had this revelation. On holiday, my partner and I fall so easily into this romantic, connected, playful space that makes it so easy to move into an erotic space. And I've always wondered, why is it so easy on holiday? Now I realize, oh, it's because we're in the play space when we're on holiday. Couples getaways are a common feature in people's narratives of when they have the most satisfying sex, perhaps especially for couples whose children are no longer little kids but are still very much in the house all the time. This isn't true for everyone, but it might be true for you. Is vacation play? As fictional interwar detective Lord Peter Wimsey says, the only sin that passion can commit is to be joyless. It must lie down with laughter or make its bed in hell. There can be no middle way. And on his wedding night, following a series of farcically unsexy fiascos, Lord Peter whispers to his chuckling bride as he climbs into bed, "What does it matter? What does anything matter? We are here. Laugh, lover, laugh. This is the end of the journey and the beginning of all delights." As you consider the play space in your emotional mind, you can ask yourself the same questions from the lust section, but now you also begin to investigate the relationships among the different spaces. How do you know when you're in that space? What happens in your body, thoughts, and emotions when you're there? How do you feel about this space? What spaces are adjacent? What pulls you into that space, and what pushes you out? Play when the stakes are high. I'm often asked by medical providers what couples can do to maintain a sexual connection when they're trying to get pregnant. My answer is simple. First, help them manage expectations, for example, by being clear that it's not rare for it to take a year, which can be inconvenient, I know. The couple may have a plan and a timeline, but their reproductive cells may or may not be on board. And second, play. Your partner is still a whole person, not just hormones and gametes, and you are still a whole person too. Meet together in an erotic space that is for you as a couple, not for baby making. I began giving this advice to medical providers after I talked to a couple who waited in line for most of an hour to have a book signed and to tell me their story, hoping that I would tell others. They were among the many couples whose sex lives had been adversely affected by their efforts to get pregnant. Fertility treatment and the scheduling demands of planning sex around conception are notoriously damaging to the erotic connection between partners. After more than a year of this, which again is not rare, both AJ and her partner were burnt out. They started resenting sex and each other. When did things turn around for them? When they decided it was funny. They switched their mindset from dread, frustration, and self-doubt to humor, play, and connection. It's a brilliant strategy if you can manage it. Though it isn't always easy, people's entire sense of self can be wrapped up in their efforts to become parents, especially if there are pregnancy losses involved. The struggle can include profound grief. That's normal and real and nothing to make light of. And it's part of what makes this couple's story so important. They turn toward each other's difficult feelings with enough calm, warm curiosity to remember that whether they got pregnant or not, they loved each other and wanted their partner to be happy. So they made it funny for each other's sake. Play is consequence-free with zero stakes. For a lot of folks, that is the opposite of sex for conception. But sex is inherently funny if you can see it through the emotional wall of wanting to get pregnant. I mean, when else in life is ejaculation so serious? Ejaculation, outside the context of fertilization, can be truly hilarious. Remember when ejaculation was fun and funny? Intergamete couples, i.e. one person has sperm and one person has eggs, who expect to get pregnant by having intercourse, have a very specific experience of how trying impacts your sex life. So, for intergamete reproducers of all genders, remember play. It is the antidote to the intensely high stakes that come with sex when you're trying to get pregnant. Seeking. Seeking is the space of exploration, curiosity, adventure, moving toward. What will you find just beyond that open door? Also known by names like exploration or learning, seeking is the key to much of human endeavor, including our motivation to listen to a book about sex so that we can improve our lives. For some people, seeking can look like going to an art museum or seeing a movie or taking a cooking class or attending a lecture. It can be nerding out over a pop culture obsession, traveling to a foreign country, or meeting new people. Whether you're exploring with your body or with your mind, or most often both, when you feel an urge to solve a problem, improve a system, have a new experience, or understand something you didn't before, you're in the seeking space. It's the, ooh, what's that state of mind that leads you to try something new. Seeking has always been my primary way in. All my relationships before my marriage happened while I was a student. And sexual initiation was easy because it flowed naturally from our ordinary conversation, which was often about my partner's research or mine. Shared intellectual exploration opened a door directly into lust. On the TV show Grey's Anatomy, season 13, episode 16, April and Jackson figure out how to do a never-before-attempted surgery together. Excitedly, they convince the guy in charge that this is a good idea. Actually, they scrub in, they say scalpel. At the same time, they operate together through sexy, affectionate eye gazing, made all the more intense by the fact that the only part of their faces we can see between surgical mask and surgical caps is their eyes. Their shining, smiling eyes. They save a little girl's life and her voice. And what do? When they get back to the hotel, exhausted from hours of surgery? Do they sleep? Heck no, not before they totally do it. Curiosity, exploration, problem solving, high stakes collaboration all blend with their existing emotional and sexual connection, and they can't resist the pull into the lust space. If you have gotten to lust through seeking, maybe you and a partner were solving problems together, whether it was a home plumbing DIY or an academic quandary. Or maybe you were traveling through unknown places and the adventure of it, the shared exploration, transformed into lust when you got to bed that night. Lust through seeking can also look like the couple I know who left their jobs, sold most of their stuff, and traveled together for a year. It was not always fun, but it was an adventure, dwelling in a constant state of novelty, exploration, and shared problem solving. Felt like foreplay, they said. Sounds exhausting to me, but I love it for them. They loved it for them too, and they have the babies to show for it, which is still another adventure. In what context do you experience curiosity? What do you love to learn about? What new experiences feel rewarding? What kinds of exploration are not interesting to you? Some people adore travel and all the novelty it brings, which might be a way into their lust state. Some people would rather stay home with the comfort and predictability it brings, which might be a way into their lust state. People vary and they change, and there is no right or wrong. Get to know your sense of curiosity, because that space is going to be where a lot of problems get solved, as we'll see in part two. Consider the questions. How do you know you're in seeking? What happens in your body, thoughts, and emotions when you're there? How do you feel about this space? What spaces are adjacent? What pulls you into that space? And what pushes you out? Care. Care is the space of love and tenderness, both taking care of and caring for. In Come As You Are, I called the care system by another of its scientific names, attachment. But its real-life name is simply love. It shows up deep in our biology, as in the burst of oxytocin that induces uterine contractions and memory lactation at the end of pregnancy. To care and be cared for is a biological drive. Humans sicken and even die from loneliness. If what you want when you want sex is connection, you're linking care and lust. For some people, sex is a fairly peripheral expression of care. But for others, perhaps especially those with reliably higher sexual desire, sex may be the most powerful way of being in care. Because it's such a sprawling part of the human experience, I like to think of care as an open concept room with multiple functional areas all in one big space. The living room of care has a cozy fireplace, a cushy sofa, and a soft rug to dig your toes into. It's the room in which adults exist in a loving, mutually supportive peer relationship full of affection and joy and trust and admiration. For a lot of people, there's a hallway or even just a door straight from the living room of care into the garden of lust. One of my favorite fictional examples of living room caring for care in a romance novel is Alyssa Cole's Radio Silence, when suddenly there's no power, no cell phones, no running water, and no one knows why. Arden and Gabriel depend on each other to survive, even though they don't like each other much at first. Through their struggles to stay alive, they build a bond of intimacy. It's not one person taking care of the other, but mutual care, mutual responsibility. When they overreact emotionally, which of course they sometimes do because it's an apocalypse, they apologize. When they have any opportunity to think beyond food and shelter and injuries, they consider each other's comfort and pleasure. Baths, music, and above all, creating moments of kindness to hold each other's grief. As their situation stabilizes and their connection grows stronger, they learn to comfort each other, reading aloud from a stash of romance novels they find in a cabin, or, as Arden puts it, fucking each other senseless. That's how caring for can connect to the lust room. But our open concept room of care also has a kitchen where you take care of, rather than care for, others. This is the workhorse of the care room. It's powerful and beautiful, but if you're taking care of your partner in the kitchen of care, it can feel too much like parenting, and it does not lead straight to the bedroom. When care shows up as cleaning up after, that's rarely sexy. Many parents of small children are in a state of constant near panic and exhaustion. Their lives consist of endless laundry, dishes, schedules of pickups and drop-offs, crackers and juice boxes. Even when a couple is collaborating effectively, working as a team to meet their family's needs, they're often stuck in an emotional corner, unable to get to lust or play or seeking. Nan Wise, in her book Why Good Sex Matters, describes this to a client in her own inimitable way. Your care system is cock-blocking your lust system. And it can be even worse when one partner isn't just taking care of the small young humans in their home. If they're also caretaking for the other partner, it's an emotional hall of mirrors. You're in care, and everything you look at is care, meaning a responsibility, an obligation, a requirement, a duty to sacrifice your time, energy, and emotion in the service of these other people. Of course you can't get to lust from there. If getting stuck in the caretaking corner is your situation, the language of the dual nature of the care space can help you talk with your partner about how to get out. Your partner can say, "I see you're trapped in care. I hear you saying that even loving touch is irritating because it only feels like more kid hands touching you. What help do you need so that you can get out of care and get some rest?" In a heterosexual relationship, the humorous term chore play comes from the idea that women get turned on seeing their husbands do chores. It's why I always get a laugh when I say, "Sometimes the sexiest thing you can do is the dishes." A friend of mine once told me, "Forget roses. When it's 15 degrees Fahrenheit out and the wind is howling and my husband is under the car hood trying to get it started so you can go somewhere, that opens the door to the lust room." Chore play is caring for, which can help a partner escape the caretaking corner. When therapist Esther Perel talks about intimacy as an enemy of passion, care is what she's talking about. But when John Gottman talks about intimacy as a key to passion, it's what he's talking about too. She means the caretaking corner. He means the living room of caring for. As you consider the care space in your emotional mind, ask yourself the questions. How do you know you're in that space? What happens in your body, thoughts, and emotions when you're in there? How do you feel about this space? What spaces are adjacent? What pulls you into that space, and what pushes you out? Amma and Di. Romantic comedies, for all their faults, can illustrate how play creates an erotic context. Take my friend Amma. A mom and wife with a full-time job plus a side hustle, she gets one night each week entirely to herself, while her wife, Di, takes care of their three kids, who range in age from toddler to teenager. What does she choose to do with this time alone? Exercise? Pray? Nap? Any of the other activities she knows nourish her? No. She can do all of that in her daily life. This is not a time for nourishment. It's a time for indulgence. In this protected downtime, Amma watches rom-coms. Amma and I already communicated well about sex, but the metaphor of the floor plan offered language to articulate something Amma had noticed but not been able to describe. After Amma learned about the emotional floor plan, she told me how it helped her express her observation and how she and Di put it into action. I was watching this rom-com, and I noticed these characters were hardcore teasing each other, and that's what was hot about their connection. And I realized that's what I want, a play approach to connection. I want humor and levity, which we have very little of in our lives right now, just because we have so much life management with work and the kids and everything. As the lower desire partner, even in a strong, satisfied sexual connection, there may be a partner with lower desire, with a stressful, exhausting life, Amma wanted to find more ways in to an erotic connection. Having the language of the room next door helped her to communicate this idea to her partner. We had both had a long day, but Di joined me in the shower, which is the place where we can just talk about things, and she asked what I was thinking about. I said, "I think I need joking around." Before, I might have said something like, "I need you to be happy," which is an unreasonable thing to ask, obviously. Like, a person can't just be happy, but she can play around. And she did all that next day, teasing me, joking with me, being playful. And that night, we had the most amazing sex. I want to point out an especially insightful aspect of Amma's new language. She transitioned from, "I need you to be happy," to, "I need joking around." That's a transition from, "I need your individual internal state to change," to, "I need our shared dynamic to change." In other words, it's not your job, it's our shared job. For anyone who wants their partner to want them spontaneously, like Mike, or wants themselves to want sex more easily, like Margot, this is how you transition away from wanting to change someone, yourself or someone else, toward wanting to change the context. The pleasure adverse spaces. And now we come to the adverse emotional spaces, that is, the spaces we're motivated to avoid experiencing. Panic, grief, fear, and rage are distinct from one another, but they are all emotional spaces where we are likely to interpret sensations as potential threats, things to be avoided. As you listen, remember this. Difficult feelings are not dangerous. Difficult feelings are not dangerous because they, like all feelings, are tunnels. When you go all the way through them, you get to the light at the end. They may be uncomfortable for sure, that's kind of their point. When you experience them, that's your embodied mind alerting you that it perceives a potential problem or a threat. But the feelings themselves are not dangerous, just as a lifeguard's whistle alerting everyone to get out of the ocean is not dangerous. What's potentially dangerous is the shark, or the rip current, or the lightning. That's why you get out of the water. There is no need to fear the whistle. Most of the time, these three emotional spaces are distant from lust. But because difficult, pleasure-adverse emotions are inevitable in any relationship that lasts long enough, getting to know these spaces is essential to learning to cultivate a sexual connection over many years.